Well, good afternoon. This is the Dogs Program. The Australian Council for Defence of Government Schools are here every Saturday at 12 noon to defend and to promote public education. Now, public education is a foundation for our democracy, and it's also a foundation for having a cohesive society because it is open to all children, whatever their class, their creed, or their colour. And yet, in Australia, and certainly in the Western world, in the UK and in America at the moment, there are people who wish to fracture our social cohesiveness, our social contract, where we all want to get on together. Here in Australia, we mainly are immigrants, with perhaps the exception, certainly over many, many thousands of years, of our First Nations people, all of us. Are only here for a few generations, and dare I say, most of us are mongrels. We can't really say that we're racially pure, and yet there is this almost a eugenics movement in the United States and in the UK at the moment. But our public education system can cut across all this because the grown-ups might have a few problems, but why should the children? We all learn, we all must learn to live together. Those of us who've gone to public schools understand that very, very well. And that is why our public schools are so important. But our press release 1052 will indicate that all is not always well. The president of the New South Wales Teachers Federation is a man from Malaysia of Indian background. And here he is in Australia. He's grown up in Australia, so he's Australian, whatever else you want to call him. But not everybody is prepared to accept such people. Let's hear from Andy about press release 1052.
Thanks, Jean. This is the Australian Council for the Defence of Government Schools, press release number 1052. The role of public schools in the current political climate. Public schools are public in access. They are open to all, regardless of their class, creed, or colour. They have enabled us to educate children from many, many backgrounds, producing a multicultural community that is refusing to allow those who would divide and rule impose a racist, authoritarian agenda upon our nation. Private schools with our taxpayer billions have different objectives. They select children, teachers and employees on religious, financial, cultural and even sexual orientation criteria. Our public schools are a bulwark against division. They can teach the new generation how to strengthen our universal institutions, defend our shared values, and prove racists wrong by building an even more inclusive, confident nation. In the current political climate, there are those who would demonise the other and fracture our society with internal conflict. The New South Wales Teachers Federation president is a gentleman of Indian background from Malaysia. His personal experience, described in an article from the Sydney Morning Herald on the 8th of September 2025, illustrates why we should keep fighting for our public system of education. Three young men told me I didn't belong here, but they're wrong. Last Monday morning at Darling Harbour, three young men approached me with a swagger that felt newly emboldened. Their words were crude, their intent clear. I didn't belong here. As an Australian man with Indian-Malaysian heritage who has lived in this country for decades, I nonetheless felt the effect of the ugly scenes and rhetoric we witnessed this time last week. This personal confrontation was no isolated incident. It was the toxic spillover from the weekend's so-called March for Australia rallies, which drew more than 45,000 protesters nationally and were infiltrated by neo-Nazis chanting Heil Australia. The atmosphere of hate these rallies generated doesn't confine itself to Hyde Park or Federation Square. It seeps into everyday encounters, emboldens the worst instincts and makes people like me question their place in a country they call home. My parents made the decision to leave Malaysia seeking better quality of life in Australia and a deeper racial equality. They found it, as millions before and since have done. Australia has been our safe haven, our opportunity, our home. But moments like last Sunday made many of us question that narrative. Racism is not new to this country. What's different now is how its public expression has been emboldened by far-right rallies that make division and hatred mainstream. The scenes from Sydney, Melbourne, Brisbane and Adelaide were performances of exclusion, designed to make people like my family feel unwelcome in the only country many of us have ever known as adults. Yet here's what the organisers of the rallies got wrong. They don't represent Australia. The overwhelming decency of most Australians was evident in the immediate response. Counter-protests that drew thousands, widespread political condemnation from across the spectrum, and community leaders who stood up to reject the politics of division. Australia remains one of the world's most successful multicultural societies, not by accident, but by design. We have absorbed waves of migration, from the post-war European migrants to refugees fleeing Vietnam by boat, from Lebanese families escaping civil war to recent arrivals from Afghanistan, and each time we have emerged stronger, more vibrant, more ourselves. It was not lost on fair-minded people that those screaming "send them back" deliberately ignore the fact that we live on stolen country, Aboriginal land, in a nation that has yet to reconcile its history, atrocity and lies. Indeed, the inflammatory and racist anti-Indian immigration comments by Liberal Senator Jacinta Nabagina Price did nothing more than expose, once again, her contempt for the ideals and values of everyday Australians of all backgrounds, Indigenous and non-Indigenous. Federal and state politicians rightly denounced the rallies as hateful and divisive, but condemnation, while necessary, is insufficient. The question is not whether we reject racism, most of us do. The question is whether we have the institutional strength to build something better. Australia's success as a diverse nation rests not only on migrants' resilience, but on strong, universal public institutions that anchor belonging beyond rhetoric. These are the practical foundations of inclusion. In our public schools, children from every background learn together, play together, and forge the friendships that define the next generation's Australia. When a Sudanese Australian child and an Italian Australian child work on a science project together in Year 8, they're learning chemistry and practicing civics. Similar experiences are seen across our TAFE colleges. Medicare ensures that healthcare is a right, not a privilege determined by postcode or surname. When every Australian has access to the same emergency room, the same GP bulk billing system, we reinforce the principle that we're all in this together. The ABC provides a shared national conversation, a common set of facts and stories that reflect the full breadth of Australian experience. These are the sinews of social cohesion. These institutions are bulwarks against division, offering real inclusion where rhetoric often fails. Last Sunday's protests were fueled by fear and misinformation about housing, economic insecurity, and social change. The antidote to that fear isn't just better messaging, it's investment in the universal public goods that make everyone's life better. When housing is affordable, when public schools and TAFE colleges are well-resourced, when healthcare is accessible, and when economic opportunity is broadly shared, the scapegoating loses its power. People don't turn on their neighbours when they feel secure in their own prospects. This requires more than words of condemnation. It requires sustained investment in the institutions that make Australia work for everyone. This is a good nation, populated by decent people. Racism exists in every society, and the extent to which it flourishes depends on all of us. The three young men who confronted me don't define Australia any more than the hateful rhetoric of last Sunday's rallies. What defines us is our choice, to strengthen our universal institutions, defend our shared values, and prove the racists wrong by building an even more inclusive, confident nation. That choice is before us every day. Last Sunday's ugliness reminds us why it matters so much. Yes, indeed. Back to you, Jean.
Well, thank you very much, Andy. And now we're going to go to not just primary and secondary education, but to tertiary education, because there's been developments here in Australia which are worrying. And once again, Andy's going to tell us about it.
Thanks, Jean. Potential for social progress undermined by attacks on universities. And this is a piece published by the New South Wales Teachers Federation on the 18th of September. Strengthening educational institutions is vital in the pursuit of justice and progress. Professor Verity Firth said in her address at the Jessie Street National Women's Library annual luncheon on the 15th of September. Federation is a proud supporter of the Specialist Library, dedicated to the preservation of Australian women's work and history. Drawing on her extensive experience in government and the education sector, Professor Firth discussed how recent right-wing populist attacks against universities threaten social progress and undermine the legacy of activists like the esteemed feminist and library namesake Jessie Street, 1889 to 1970. "I've always seen education as the great equaliser in an otherwise unequal world," she said. "It's one of the very few tools we have left that can genuinely change the trajectory of people's lives. But we're really at quite an interesting and challenging historical moment for universities." Professor Firth highlighted how mounting challenges within the university sector threaten to diminish their vital role as hubs of civic engagement and democratic discourse, especially in the social sciences and humanities. "These disciplines help us understand ourselves and each other. They give us the tools to interpret history, navigate culture, and shape policy. They foster empathy, ethical reasoning, and civic imagination." She warned, "We are in an age of misinformation, polarisation, and the significant evolution of technology with the rise of AI. We need social sciences and humanities more than ever. It's these disciplines that help us understand the human context behind the technology, how it shapes our society's values and identities. They equip us to ask who benefits, who is left out, and they ensure that as we build smarter machines, we don't lose sight of what it means to be human." Professor Firth concluded by referring to Jessie Street's work, Campaigning for Peace and Progress, reaffirming the importance of education in the pursuit of social justice. The Jessie Street National Women's Library is an invaluable resource for teachers and students. Welcome to all. The library is located within the Ultimo Community Centre, 523 to 525 Harris Street, Ultimo in Sydney, open between 10 a.m. and 3 p.m. on weekdays. The library is self-funding and relies on memberships, donations and fundraisers to continue their important work. Professor Firth is the Vice President of Societal Impact, Equity and Engagement at the University of New South Wales and the Professor of Practice within the School of Education. She served as Minister for Education and Training from 2008 to 2011 and currently sits as a Board Director for the Teachers Mutual Bank. Back to you, Jean.
Well, it's pretty heavy stuff, so let's have a quick break, shall we?
Help us stay radical. Become a regular donor to 3CR. A regular donor is someone who loves 3CR so much that they set up an automatic donation to 3CR on the same day every month. Will you help 3CR by becoming a regular donor today? Together, we can keep independent voices on air. Go to 3cr.org.au.
Panoply, panorama, panpipe, pansy. Aha, pansexual, knowing no boundaries of sex or gender. Sound interesting? Then join Sally on Sundays at noon for Out of the Pan. All those gender questions making you think too hard? Whether it's transgender, bisexual, polyamorous or beyond, we'll throw those questions into the pan and cook up the answers for you. So go on, push that gender envelope, only on 3CR 855am digital and 3cr.org.au.
Well, we hope you're still listening to the Dogs program because Dale has been doing some research and she's come up with a Pearls and Irritations article from John Menadue's blog. And this article is a very interesting one because it's about breaking the mould. But really, we suspect that it's just a rehashed version of what is known as the integrated public school system, in which the private schools come under state funding, but they don't charge any fees. Anyway, over to Dale.
I have an interesting article by Lawrence Ingvarsson titled School Funding, Time to Break the Mould and Build a New Model. a deep contradiction has developed between Australia's values and the way our schools are funded. At the National Press Club, Prime Minister Albanese declared, "On the 3rd of May, the Australian people voted for Australian values, for fairness, aspiration and opportunity for all. Yet our education system no longer reflects those values. Among OECD nations, Australia now has one of the most socially segregated school systems. More than 80% of students from disadvantaged families attend public schools, compared with just 12% in Catholic schools and 8% in independent schools. Australia's performance on international tests, such as PISA, has steadily declined since 2000, with widening gaps between advantaged and disadvantaged students. Too many young people are underachieving, their potential wasted. Our funding model is clumsy, costly, and wasteful, designed more by political compromise than by principles of fairness or efficiency." How we got here? The roots stretch back to the Whitlam era, but the Howard government's new schools policy of the late 1990s accelerated the trend. It encouraged almost any group, religious or otherwise, to establish schools, even where public schools already existed. These schools were funded largely by the Commonwealth, allowed to charge fees and to select students. The result is a funding system that outsiders find almost impossible to decipher. 30 years later, the negative consequences of this model are clear. It is seriously undermining our public school system, dividing communities, and costing far more than it needs to. It entrenches inequality, yet survives because every reform attempt meets fierce resistance. Still, there has never been a better time for a Commonwealth government to design a fairer, simpler, and less wasteful model. How the model divides communities. The story of Bacchus Marsh is repeated across the nation. The local public high school, founded in 1921, is open to all and funded mainly by the state. In 1988, a new grammar school opened nearby, funded primarily by the Commonwealth, but also charging fees and selecting students. In 2023, Bacchus Marsh College received $17,631 per student, the schooling resource standard. The grammar school, however, received $24,437 per student, half from governments, half from fees. A third of its recurrent funding went into capital works, with more than $36 million spent on new facilities in 2023. The college, however, managed just $2.6 million. Predictably, this created an uneven playing field and divided the community. Students at the college now come from families more disadvantaged than 67% of Australian schools, compared with only 13% at the grammar school. 40% of grammar students are from non-English speaking backgrounds, compared with 10% at the college. Unsurprisingly, the grammar school boasts higher retention rates, stronger test results, and greater community satisfaction. Graduates from the college find their career options limited, not by talent, but by circumstance. This pattern is repeated across the nation. With fees exceeding $8,000 a year, many Catholic schools now enroll far fewer students from disadvantaged families than they once did, and significantly fewer than nearby public schools. How the model escalates costs. What has become clear are the harmful consequences of allowing some schools to receive public funding and to charge fees in a largely unregulated and expanding market. An arms race of extravagant capital works across Melbourne non-government schools has been evident for many years. As a result, parents are paying fees well above the schooling resource standard, which estimates the funding a school needs to meet its students' education needs. For example, families of Baldwin High School and Carey Baptist Grammar School in Melbourne are at nearly similar levels of socio-education advantage. In 2023, Baldwin High School's total recurrent income per student was $16,250. while Kerry's was $42,196, 81% of which comes from fees. Nearly one-third of its income was directed into items such as capital works. Kerry spent more than $21 million on capital works in 2023. Baldwin High School spent $570,000. Yet, there was little difference in educational outcomes, such as VCE results and NAPLAN scores. Admittedly, these are not the only desirable outcomes. Kerry may offer more extracurricular activities, but questions arise about the relative efficiency of the two schools, as well as whether parents are truly getting value for money. As this pattern is repeated across Australia, it's not surprising that the country has the highest level of expenditure on private educational institutions in the OECD. 0.7% of GDP, more than double the OECD-wide average of 0.3%. What reform could look like? Recent increases in federal Gonski funding are welcome, but fail to address the core problem, the split between federal funding for private schools and state funding for public schools. This division has been entrenching inequality and makes little educational sense. It's time to be honest with ourselves and admit we can't afford to go further down this road. Countries that perform better on international tests, such as Canada, the UK, Ireland, and New Zealand, offer choice within a publicly funded system. Schools may have distinct features, but they cannot charge fees. This keeps performance gaps smaller and prevents segregation by class. Australia could adopt a similar model. Both levels of government would develop a common formula based on a revised SRS to fully fund all schools, government and non-government. Schools could retain their ethos but would not be allowed to charge fees. Most private schools already receive close to or above 80% of the SRS, so the additional cost would be less than many assume. Such reform would not abolish choice. It would simply make choice affordable and equitable. As in the UK and Canada, only a small minority of schools would remain outside the system. Facing the objections, Independent Schools Australia has already called for all schools to move to 100% of the SRS, regardless of sector. That principle should apply, but without fees on top. If non-government schools claim they cannot survive without fees, the obvious question follows. Why are public schools expected to survive on that level of funding? Critics brand reform class warfare, but what is truly divisive is a model that enables private schools to segregate students by class and achievement while offering their staff better pay and conditions. A matter of values. At its best, education binds a nation together. In Australia, it's increasingly dividing us by income, by religion, by postcode. No parent should have to make sacrifices to secure a good education, nor should any child's opportunities depend on their family's wealth. Countries that outperform us show that fairness and excellence are not opposites. Smaller performance gaps, better average outcomes, and cheaper, more efficient systems are possible. Australia can do the same. Our best hope for reform in years lies with the current Labor government. Designing a funding system consistent with its social justice principles is not only urgent, it is a test of whether we truly value fairness, aspiration, and opportunity for all. And that article was by Lawrence Ingvarsson. It is interesting to see people try to come up with ideas that will placate all comers. The dogs might argue that unless you are going to accept all students, you do not deserve any taxpayer money. The solution is having a gold standard public education system, public to all in outcome, public to all in access, public to all in ownership, and public to all in accountability.
Well, thanks very much, Dale. Very interesting article. But really having two bowl both ways when it comes to the point. We at the Dogs don't have two bowl both ways. We're against state aid to private schools because we're also in favour of church-state separation. Because it's not only education that is been corrupted by state money to religious organisations, it's also charities. And in Parliament, Shoebridge has been questioning the government over the delay in responding to proposed charity reforms. There's been a lot of trouble with religious charities. If you've been looking at Four Corners lately, I think last week, there was a very interesting program on Indeed about the exclusive Brethren. And there are many charities and their lack of paying tax. Anyway, let's hear about it, shall we?
Thanks, Jean. Shoebridge questions government over delay in responding to proposed charities reforms. And this was published by the Rationalist Society of Australia on the 16th of September and written by Cy Gladman. The Albanese government is facing questioning on why it has yet to respond to recommendations for reforms to the charities sector, including to religious charities, about 16 months after receiving them. Greens Senator David Shoebridge has placed questions on notice in the federal parliament, asking the government about when it intends to respond to the Productivity Commission's report for its inquiry into philanthropy. The Productivity Commission's report recommended, among other things, removal of the Basic Religious Charities category from the Australian Charities and Not-for-Profits Commission, ACNC, Act 2012, in order to enhance regulatory consistency and public transparency. The report was handed to the government on the 10th of May 2024 and released to the public on the 18th of July 2024. BRCs, organisations with charity status for advancing religion, enjoy exemptions to the governance standards and financial reporting requirements that apply to other charities, including religious organisations that do not have BRC status. In the report, the Productivity Commission said it had carefully considered submissions and evidence provided at public hearings, but could not identify a policy rationale that justifies retaining BRCs. The Rationalist Society of Australia, RSA, wrote to the Minister responsible for charities, Andrew Lee, last December to ask him when the government would respond to the report, but Dr. Lee has not replied to the RSA. In the new questions placed on notice in the Senate, Senator Shoebridge seeks answers from the government on who is tasked with working on a response to the report and why it is taking so long. In the days before Christmas last year, the Treasury Department told Senator Shoebridge that the timing of a response was a matter for government. Upon the release of the Productivity Commission's report, Dr. Lee swiftly and publicly rejected another key recommendation, the removal of deductible gift recipient, DGR, status for school building funds, despite the report showing that DGR status for such funds overwhelmingly benefited the wealthiest, mostly faith-based private schools. The Productivity Commission also recommended the removal of DGR status for religious education activities in government schools and all activities for the purpose of advancing religion. At Senate estimates in 2022, Senator Shoebridge raised concerns about the fraught environment created by a lack of transparency and accountability over BRCs, with government officials even confirming that potentially billions of dollars were going unreported in the economy because of BRCs. In two submissions to the Productivity Commission's inquiry, in mid-2023 and in early 2024, the RSA said the exemptions enjoyed by BRCs undermined the integrity of the charities system and public trust. In its own submission, the charities regulator, the Australian Charities and Not-for-Profits Commission, ACNC, recognised that the exemptions may be reducing public trust and confidence in the charities system. The RSA has directly urged Dr. Lee to support the Productivity Commission's recommendation on BRCs. In September last year, it also joined with a number of pro-secular organisations in writing to Dr. Lee on the matter. Religious lobbyists responded angrily to the Productivity Commission's recommendations, describing the independent research and advisory body as having a clear anti-religion agenda and as having mounted a direct attack on faith communities. In August last year, the RSA reported that religious lobbyists were demanding the government continue to recognise faith-based charities as special and give them due respect. The Rationalist Society of Australia is actively campaigning for reform of the charities sector. And that sounds like a really good idea. Back to you, Jean.
Well, thanks, Andy, and also thank you to the Rationalist Society for that article. But now we'll go to the Australian Education Union, and they're concerned that the productivity reforms should support teachers, not reshape the profession. So let's hear from them.
Thanks, Jean. Productivity reforms must support teachers, not reshape their profession. And this is an Australian Education Union press release from the 16th of September. The Mackell Institute's Freeing Teachers to Teach report, which shows that productivity gains in education come from freeing teachers from unnecessary administration, not from hollowing out their profession, sends a strong message to governments that any productivity reforms must support teachers and not reshape their profession. This report, in response to the Productivity Commission's inquiry, Building a Skilled and Adaptable Workforce, outlines how supporting teachers, particularly when there is a teacher shortage crisis, is critical for national productivity, and that any productivity reforms must support teachers and not reshape their profession. The AEU strongly rejects the Productivity Commission's attempts to frame lesson planning as administration. This is particularly concerning when this directly contradicts the Productivity Commission's own 2023 review of the National School Reform Agreement, which argued for teachers' administrative burden to be reduced so they could have more time available for lesson planning. Lesson planning is at the core of the teaching profession. It is intellectual, creative, collaborative, and essential to tailoring teaching and learning for students, AEU Federal President Corinna Haythorpe said. Australia is in the midst of a teacher recruitment and retention crisis driven by escalating workloads and more than a decade of underfunding for public schools. What is needed is investment in better wages and conditions and more resources for public schools. The Mackell Institute report also emphasises that reforms proposed by the Productivity Commission risk reshaping the role of teachers into content deliverers rather than skilled educators, which Ms. Haythorpe warns would worsen attrition and demoralise the profession. We cannot let productivity become code for de-skilling teachers. Teachers are highly skilled professionals, not content deliverers. Removing teacher autonomy from lesson planning would see more teachers leave the profession, Ms. Haythorpe said. The UN High-Level Panel on the Teaching Profession highlights the importance of professional autonomy for teachers. Teacher autonomy and agency are important factors of job satisfaction, commitment, and professional status. Teacher autonomy refers to the decisions over pedagogical approaches and curricula based on knowledge, competence, and responsibility within education goals. Teacher well-being is influenced by the degree of perceived work autonomy and directly relates to job satisfaction. Productivity reforms must reduce red tape, not strip the heart out of teaching. Reducing teaching to the delivery of pre-packaged content risks undermining teacher expertise and narrowing their role. The report explicitly highlights that redeploying genuine administrative and compliance work away from teachers could free up between 67 million and 106 million hours annually for lesson planning, collaboration, and teaching. This could restore up to 334 hours a year to each teacher in Australia for planning, collaboration, and improved work-life balance. It also states that supporting teacher well-being, reducing workload pressures, and creating pathways for long-term careers must be government priorities, as they are essential to student success and broader productivity. Genuine solutions to increase productivity include better pay and conditions, reducing administrative load, expanding support staff in schools, respecting teachers as professionals, and fully funding our public schools so that teachers can teach and students can learn in modern, safe environments. These solutions are good for teachers, good for students, and good for our nation as a whole, Ms. Haythorpe said. And I couldn't agree more. Back to you, Jean.
Once again, we've asked you to really concentrate on some pretty heavy stuff. So let's have a break and then we'll come back to our international segment.
Looking for an easy way to keep up with your annual 3CR subscription? You can now set up an annual debit from your bank account or credit card, and once a year your payment will be automatically deducted. You can cancel at any time and you'll get a reminder each year before payment. Be a constant supporter of Melbourne's precious independent community radio station and set up a recurring payment today. Just go to 3cr.org.au/subscribe.
Well, we hope you're still here at 3CR listening to the Dogs program. And now we've got Jeff, who's going to take us overseas, the UK and the US, to tell us about what's happening there.
Good afternoon, listeners. Today we're going to start out in the UK with an article from The Independent. This is an article by Sophie Wingate from the 20th of September 2025. And the article's title is Private Schools Face Ofsted Inspection Cost Hike as Phillipson to Axe Subsidies. Ofsted is the Office of Standards in Education. And she writes, private schools receiving discounted Ofsted inspections face paying the full amount under proposals by Bridget Phillipson to axe unfair state subsidies. The Education Secretary is expected to announce plans to abolish the subsidy, which currently means two-thirds of Ofsted inspection costs are effectively discounted for private institutions. The state watchdog inspects around half of England's 2,496 registered independent schools, but there's a disparity between the fees charged for checks and the full cost of recovery. The cost of providing Ofsted inspections to private schools in 24-25 was $6.5 million, according to figures set out by the then Education Minister, Stephen Morgan, earlier this month. But only $2.2 million of that, or 34%, was recovered in fees charged by Ofsted. Allies of Ms. Phillips told The Telegraph, "We want to maximise the money going into our state sector, diverting it towards priorities driving up standards across the country. Inspection is crucially important for driving up standards in all schools as well as keeping children safe. That's why we're strengthening it for private schools as well as the state schools. But it's time every independent school paid its fair share. These private schools are private businesses. It's frankly unfair. Taxpayers, most of whom send their children to state schools, shouldn't have to foot the bill to make sure they're accountable to fee-paying parents. Plans to remove the subsidy are expected to be set out in a consultation launched this week. The Labor government in January removed the VAT exemption and business rates relief for private schools to enable funding for 6,500 new teachers in state schools." And that's the end of that article. Now we're going to go to the United States, and there's couple of interesting stories here. The first one is by Thomas Ulticken, who on the 21st of September published on his blog, and this is republished on the Network for Public Education, which I highly encourage you to have a look at. And this article is "A Shocking Effort to End Public Schooling," he writes. This year, state legislators have proposed in excess of 110 laws pertaining to public education. Of those laws, 85 were centred on privatising K-12 schools. Republican lawmakers sponsored 83 of the pro-privatisation laws, which begs the question, has the grand old party become the grifting oligarch's party? When did they become radicals out to upend the foundation of American greatness? The Conservative Party has a long history of being anti-Labor and has always been a hard sell when it came to social spending. However, they historically have supported public education and especially their local schools. It seems the conservative and careful GOP is gone and been replaced by a wild bunch. It's stupefying to see them propose radical ideas like using public money to fund education savings accounts, ESAs, with little oversight. Parents are allowed to use ESA funds for private schools, including religious schools, for homeschool expenses or educational experiences like horseback riding lessons. A review of all the 2025 state education legal proposals was used to create a table, and he's given the table there where Republicans dominate the drive to promote privatisation. In this table, ESA indicates tax credit-funded voucher programs. There have been 40 bills introduced to create ESA programs, plus another 20 bills designed to expand existing ESA programs. Most of the 2025 proposed laws are in progress, but the governors of Texas, Tennessee, Idaho, and Wyoming have signed and ratified new ESA-style laws. In addition, governors in Indiana, South Carolina, and New Hampshire signed laws expanding ESA vouchers in their states. None of the 16 proposals to protect public education or three laws to repeal an existing ESA program were signed by a governor or passed by a legislature. Fighting in the courts. June 13th, the Wyoming Education Association, WEA, and nine parents filed a lawsuit challenging the Steamboat Legacy Scholarship Act, Wyoming's new voucher program. The suit charged that the program violates the Wyoming Constitution in two key ways, one for directing public dollars to private enterprises, which the lawsuit says is clearly prohibited, the second for violating the Constitution's mandate that Wyoming provide a complete and uniform system of education. On July 15, District Court Judge Peter Froelicher granted a preliminary injunction against the state's universal voucher program. He wrote, "The court finds and concludes plaintiffs are therefore likely to succeed on the merits of their claims that the act fails when strict scrutiny is applied. The injunction will remain in effect until the plaintiff's claims have been fully litigated and decided by this court." Last year, the Utah Association sued the state, arguing that the Utah Fits All Scholarship Program violated the Constitution April 21st. District Court Judge Laura Scott ruled that Utah's $100 million voucher program is unconstitutional. At the end of June, the Utah Supreme Court agreed to hear an appeal of Scott's ruling. However, the decision seems well-founded. The Montana legislature in 2023 established a statewide education savings account, ESA, voucher program. It allows families of students with disabilities to use public funds deposited into personal bank accounts for private education expenses. In April this year, Montana Quality Education Coalition and Disability Rights, Montana, brought suit to overturn this program. In July, the Montana Federation of Public Employees and the organisation Public Funds Public Schools joined the plaintiffs in suit. The legal action awaits its day in court. At the end of June, a Missouri State Teachers Association sued to end the enhanced Mo Scholars program, which began in 2021, funded by a tax credit scheme. This year, in order to expand the program, the state's legislature added $51 million in taxpayer dollars to the scheme. The teachers' suit claims this is unconstitutional and calls for the $51 million to be eliminated. Milton Friedman's Ed Choice legal advocates joined the state in defending the Moss Scholars program. Their July 30th message said, "On behalf of Missouri families, Ed Choice legal advocates filed a motion to intervene as defendants in the lawsuit brought by the Missouri National Education Association, challenging the state's expanded empowerment scholarship accounts program known as Moss Scholars. It's unlikely Ed Choice legal advocates are representing the wishes of most Missouri families." In South Carolina, the state Supreme Court ruled in 2024 that its Education Trust Fund scholarship program was unconstitutional. The lawsuit was instituted by the state teachers union, parents, and NAACP. The program resumed this year after lawmakers revised it to funnel money from the lottery system instead of the general fund. The South Carolina effort has been twice ruled unconstitutional for violating prohibitions against using public funds for the direct benefit of private education. Legislatures are proposing funneling the money through a fund that then goes to a trustee and then to parents who then use it for private schools. Sherry East, president of the South Carolina Education Association, stated, "We just don't agree and we think it's unconstitutional. We've already been to court twice. The Supreme Court has ruled twice that it's unconstitutional, so we don't understand how they're trying to do it, a loophole or a workaround. You know, they're trying to work around the Constitution and it's just a problem." The South Carolina fight seems destined to return to the courts, but they have vouchers for now. Last year in Anchorage, Alaska, Superior Court Judge Adolf Zeman concluded that there was no workable way to construe the state statutes in a way that does not violate constitutional spending rules. Therefore, the relevant laws must be struck down in their entirety. This was a result of the January 2023 lawsuit alleging that correspondence programs allotments were being used to reimburse parents for thousands of dollars in private educational institution services using public funds, thereby indirectly funding private education in violation of the Alaska Constitution. Alaska has many homeschooled students in the correspondence programs. Plaintiff attorney Scott Kendall believes the changes will not disrupt correspondence programs. He claims what is prevented here is that this purchasing from outside vendors that have essentially contorted the correspondence school program into a shadow school voucher program. So that shadow school voucher program that was in violation of the Constitution as of today with a stroke of a pen is dead. The big problem. GOP legislatures are facing difficult problems with state constitutions prohibiting sending public dollars to private schools. The straightforward solution would be to ask the public to ratify a constitutional amendment. However, voucher programs have never won a popularity vote, so getting a constitutional change to make vouchers easier to institute is not likely. Their solutions are Rube Goldberg-type laws that create 100% tax credits for contributing to a scholarship fund. A corporation or an individual can contribute to these funds and reduce their tax burden by an equal amount. Legislators must pretend that since the state never got the tax dollars, it is constitutional. Lawyers who practice bending the law might agree, but common sense tells us this is nonsense. The big problem for the anti-public school Republicans is voucher schools are not popular. They have never once won a public referendum. And that's the article. So the way the Republicans are desperately trying to channel public funds into private schools, private institutions, for-profit education, which the Dogs opposes vehemently. Now, just to end, I'd just like to talk about something that's happened this week, is the American Native American activist Leonard Peltier, after spending 50 years in jail, has been finally released, and his first interview has been granted, which you can Google. It came out on the Democracy Now! Blog and podcast and YouTube by Amy Goodman, which is used on 1,500 different television stations carry Democracy Now!, including the NPR and things like that. So I would highly recommend if you get the chance to have a listen to it. It's Leonard Peltier on Indigenous Rights, His Half Century in Prison and More. And the reason I'm mentioning it is because before he became an activist who was put in jail back in the 70s on completely fitted up charges that have been universally condemned by everyone from the Pope through every president, and only finally he was Biden in the last hours of his presidency, he granted clemency and allowed Peltier to leave prison at the age of 80. He turned 81 this week, and he's given his very first interview. Now, Leonard Peltier was, I will say, a victim of the Bureau of Indian Affairs, which runs a series of schools in all over the states. He was removed from his family at the age of 9 and put into a boarding school run by the Bureau of Indian Affairs. He went to the Flandreau Indian School in Flandreau, South Dakota. Now, these schools, which received complete public funding, but were run by the churches. This one was a Presbyterian church, and he claimed it was his first time in jail. He says that the beatings and the abuse that he received in the 3 years he was there between 1953 and 1956 were some of the worst periods of his life, and he said it was actually harder than the 50 years he did in prison. His time at that school was worse. These schools were tasked with... I'll quote you part of the text from the Wikipedia on American Indian boarding schools, which, again, were 100% funded by the federal government over there as a part of their treaty obligations, but run by the churches. And I'll just quote this paragraph. Children were typically immersed in the Anglo-American culture of the upper class. Schools forced removal of indigenous cultural signifiers, cutting the children's hair, having them wear American-style uniforms, forbidding them from speaking their mother tongues, and replacing their tribal names with English language names, saints' names under some religious orders, for use at the schools as part of assimilation and to Christianise them. The schools were usually harsh especially for younger children who had been forcibly separated from their families and forced to abandon their Native American identities and cultures. Children sometimes died in the school system due to infectious disease. Investigations of the later 20th century revealed cases of physical, emotional, and sexual abuse. So, as a survivor of one of these schools, Leonard Peltier has gone on to try to defend his people and their treaty rights as a nation who made a treaty with the American government. And you can only make a treaty with a recognised nation, is his point. And he has spent 49 years and 8 months or something like that in prison as a result. And if you do want to catch up with that, I highly recommend you find through the Democracy Now! Website or the Democracy Now! YouTube channel and have a listen to Leonard's story. It's well worth a listen. And so just must remember that not all government schools or government-funded schools are the same. In this case, these government schools were really funded by the government but run by religious institutions. And they were there to strip away any cultural vestiges that these people had. And obviously there are echoes about mission schools in Australia which had similar backgrounds. And this is not an unusual occurrence. Things like this happened in Canada and other countries as well. Certainly South America had similar stories. Anyway, with that, I will pass you back to the headquarters of the Dogs. Give a thought to Leonard Peltier and wish him well for the remainder of his life in relative freedom. And with that, I'll pass you back to the headquarters of the Dogs. Cheerio.
Well, thank you very much to Jeff. And now we're back home. And now we've got the best part of our program, our great state school. But our great state school in many ways takes us back to our very first press release when we started the program. Remember, our president from the New South Wales Teachers Federation was in Darling Point or Darling Harbour. And there is a state school there where the children in Darling Harbour are actually learning to respect people from all walks of life and all countries and all backgrounds. So let's hear about it, shall we?
Thanks, Jean. And this week's great state school of the week is Ultimo Public School in Ultimo, Sydney. Ultimo Public School serves a culturally rich and diverse school community located in an exciting and historic urban environment in Sydney, close to Darling Harbour, Haymarket and the CBD. The current school enrolment is 480 students from kindergarten to year 6 in 21 classes. 72.5% of students have a language background other than English. A professional staff committed to school excellence work with the community to nurture and challenge students. High quality and teaching and learning programs are at the core of great classroom pedagogy, and our assistant principal, curriculum and instruction, works across the school to ensure that every student improves every year. Literacy and numeracy are taught in a co-teaching environment that ensure individualised learning for all. The students at Ultimo Public School are encouraged to develop the values of care, compassion and respect, and to see themselves as global citizens with global responsibilities. An emphasis on promoting student well-being, building strong relationships, independence and resilience, creates a harmonious, respectful school culture. Class programs are supported by teachers of English as a second language, a learning support teacher, a teacher librarian, and 2 full-time Chinese community language teachers. All students in years 3 to 6 engage in a specialist music program that provides them with small group guitar lessons each week. A strong partnership with parents is evident in the wide range of ways they participate in the life of the school. Productive partnerships with organisations from the wider community deeply enrich student learning experiences. Our banner statement, Aspire, Achieve, Amaze, was developed in partnership with our school community as part of a vision building process. Our staff, students and their families believe that great things can be achieved while humility and perspective is maintained throughout life's journey. And now some facts and figures from the My School website. Full-time enrolment is 478. and the ICSEA value of the students is 1,096, slightly above average. And what that means is that 38% of students have parents in the top quartile of incomes, 37% in the second quartile, 18% below 50% quartile of incomes, and 7% in the lowest quartile of parental incomes. There are 73% of students with a language background other than English, and 2% Indigenous students. Now, the finances. Australian government recurrent funding is $1.245 million, and state government recurrent funding is $4.85 million. Fees, charges and parental contributions add another $244,000 and a further $276,000 from other private sources. And that works out to, per student, $14,255, all money well spent, with a school with good NAPLAN results. Back to you, Jean.
Well, congratulations to Ultimo Public School. If you'd like to find out more about the dogs, then you can always go to our website at www.adogs.info, or even if you want to listen to previous programs, you can go to the podcast on the 3CR website. But from all of us here at 3CR, from Dale, our wonderful producer, and Andy, her offsider, and Jeff, and Sol, and myself, it's bye for now.
Saw Joe Hill last night, alive as you and me. Says I, but Joe, you're 10 years dead. I never died, says he. I never died, says he. In Salt Lake City, Joe, says I, him standing by my bed. They framed you on a murder charge, says Joe, but I'm dead. Says Joe, but I'm dead. The copper bosses killed you, Joe. They shot you, Joe, says I. Takes more than guns to kill a man, says Joe, I didn't die, says Joe, I didn't die. And standing there as big as life and smiling with his eyes, says Joe, what they can never kill, went on to organize, went on to organize. From San Diego up to Maine, in every mine and mill, where workers strike and organize, it's there you'll find your hill. It's there you'll find your hill. I dreamed I saw Joe Hill last night, alive as you and me. Says I, but Joe, you're 10 years dead. I never died, says he.
Thanks for listening to a 3CR podcast. 3CR is an independent community radio station based in Melbourne, Australia. We rely on the financial support of listeners like yourself to keep going. Will you help 3CR by becoming a regular donor today? Together, we can keep independent voices on air. Go to 3cr.org.au, and thanks for your support.